This is a recording from Reunions Weekend 2011 at the University of Virginia, made possible by the UVA Alumni Association. This panel discussion is from the class of 1991.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. It's great to see you guys. It's been 20 years. It's hard to believe. But everyone was fantastic. And I have, before we get into the spirit of the day and what we're here for, I have a fun surprise. And actually, it's not so much a surprise when you know our class, but Alumni Hall bestows an honor or an award to the class each reunion year that has the highest percentage attendance for a proportion of the class coming back. And our class won. So, everyone's award. I'm just so pleased. And 91 just has a reputation for being a dedicated class, a committed class, and this is further underscoring that. So I'm so glad everyone's back. It's really wonderful. Okay, on to the big stuff here. How many of you were here 5 years ago? 15. Great. So did you come to the class panel? Did anyone? Okay. Well, 5 years ago, we began this discussion, both among ourselves as well as for the reunions program at UVA, and we were asked to test drive this class panel discussion idea, and this is an idea that we borrowed from Stanford University. So we took it for a test drive 5 years ago. It went over extremely well, and as a result, it has now become a staple of the reunions program. So we're the first class and only class. Well, I guess we're the first class to repeat. So we're gonna pick up where we left off, sort of, 5 years ago, and continue our chat with the help of our panelists. And let me quickly introduce them. And you're not in the order that you are, she, okay? John Dickerson from Washington D.C., Scott Edwards from New York City, Lena Ma, Egan from San Francisco, Amy Gardner from Charlottesville, Wyatt Shields, Falls Church, Reeves, Wimbish, Chicago, Illinois. And then no panel discussion would be complete without our esteemed moderator, Lewis Frischman. So let's give them all a hand.
This will be like Watson. We'll ask him some questions. Actually, Diana, can we fill up? Do you have beer still?
Yeah.
There will be consumption from that later today. Classmates, welcome back, not only to UVA, but specifically to Rouse Hall. And I know it's been 20 years. Memories might be fading a little bit. But when we were undergrads, this building was a Rouse Hall. Did anyone have classes in Rouse Hall? Right, I'm not mistaken. I mean, right. And you realize you're walking into some buildings now, you don't even recognize them. You can't even close your eyes. I will say that apparently, if you sprinkle a little bit of comm school dust in a place, magic happens. These are seats that invite you to sleep through class, so have at it. Actually, besides Scott, who was comm school, anyone else here comm school?
Yeah.
Oh my God! Back to a comm. Actually, Don, you probably saw the news in some way. You know the big development for rising third years starting in the fall of comm school?
Yeah. Pay more.
They're going to pay $3,000 a year as a tuition differential. And if memory serves, I think $3,000 for those of us who were in state when we were undergrad, $3,000 was about the entire cost of the semester, tuition, room, and board. So times have changed. Let's just leave it at that. And I suspect that's true for us too. You know, it's interesting. 5 years ago, our panel discussion sort of looked at how we were similar and how we were different at age 37 compared with when we were undergrads. And today we'll probably be taking a different tack and just sort of talking about some of the bigger issues, family, balance in life, sort of the way we deal with change. Because now that we're in our early 40s, that sort of feels appropriate. And I suspect that if we would look in the mirror, some of us are maybe a little bit grayer or blonder, I'm told. That's right. I was not asking for a show of hands. I think it's fair to say that probably a lot of us have been through a lot in the past 5 years. It's been sort of an eventful period, and I think for many people, probably a tough period. Now, that said, even if we might feel our years a little bit more, I think it's fair to say we're not... our new moderator. I think it's fair to say we're not really counting the days until our AARP membership kicks in, fortunately. But there probably are some pesky realizations we feel now that maybe we didn't even 5 years ago. I agree. For example, how many of you were up past your bedtime last night? Here's one I like. How many of you groan when you get into or out of your car? I actually drive an old Honda, and I sound worse than the car half the time. You know, guys, how many of you have a hairline that's receding faster than the Dead Sea? And there are also, you know, some more serious questions and realizations we might think about. Are there occasions where you feel that time maybe is becoming more your enemy than your friend? Or is there something you want to change about your life, but you find yourself wondering if you have the courage or the energy to actually make it happen? And with the help of our panelists today, we'll explore some of the fun and serious, some of the big and small, and definitely a little bit of trivial. I can tell you that at the end of our session today, we're going to take a stroll down memory lane with the help of our panelists, but I think they're going to need a lot of help looking at them to see just what we remember about 20 years ago when we were walking the same grounds. Let's actually start, panelists, with something we ended off with 5 years ago, which is just talking about some of the things that are good about life in our early 40s. And we'll also talk about some of the bad things. So, John, why don't you start us off? What's one of the good things about life in your early 40s? This concludes our panel.
That's actually a Dickersonian question.
I wouldn't want to be any younger. I mean, or they say they want to go back to their college years now that they know. And I've never known which camp I'm in. Because being back here, you want to, now that you know, they say that youth is wasted on the young. And now that we're back here, we think, oh, you know, if I'd done this and that and had more fun here. And on the other hand, one of the great joys of being 40 is that kids, and we get to see the world through their eyes and learn anew all of these things that we took for granted and have to explain all of these things that are part of our, you know, our daily life and the choices we make. So I guess the best part of being 40 is the way you rethink your own life through the eyes of your children who have all of that wonder that we had some small portion of when we were here. We still had wonder about the world. And kids bring them back, and so that would probably be it. So that doesn't have to do necessarily with being 40, but just being a father.
Scott, I let John stop reading my Christian. I think it's definitely family. You go through life, and I will admit that I had no idea what it was going to be like to raise children. I never knew exactly how much you live for your children, how much you love them, how much you want to teach them things, show them things. That is definitely the highlight of my 40s in this period. No competition compared to that. When you look at things, I mean, that's really, at the end of the day, your family is what you live for now. That by far is the most important thing in my life. And the happiest part about my 40s.
To do the little rat race for, you know, comparing myself against friends that I think is the core of which is probably all 5 minutes. And with Mary Garrett being one of them, and some other folks in the room. But that, there's been a group of friends that we've gone through for 24 years plus now, and gone through bad times, good times, family troubles, deaths, all of that sort of accumulation of life experience. But to be able to share that over a long period of time with friends is pretty rich, and that's that gets better.
Read
something.
Sorry, do you
last?
That was your first time. Great, so then I answered with another answer. No, so I would say it's great being 40 and having little kids. For me personally, it's just been great. Familiar enough with what's now important to me and what's not that important and how to prioritize. And we can't drive yet, which I'm sure if any good places are still out there, still home.
All right, even though Amy's sort of sweetened the pot already, what's one of the tough things for you about being really
important? I don't know, wrinkles. Like, it's such a bummer.
Everybody's years, let alone your own. And And so let's talk about a couple of those themes. First of all, I'm curious, has anyone here become a parent for the first time in the past 5 years? The first time? Why don't you, what makes you the late 30s or close to 40? Right.
Yeah, why don't you take that?
Daycare is at my
excuse for him. But I've learned to, like, not say that. So he just needs to take time to answer it himself.
Do you maybe see yourself sort of transitioning out of that mindset as a parent as they get older? Or do you think it's going to be as tough for you when they're 8, 10, and 12 as it is right now?
It'll be interesting because Aiden's in pre-K and he starts kindergarten in the fall, and that's off-campus, off the new campus. It's one ratio, student-teacher ratio is 1 to 22. There's a large percentage of free and reduced lunch kids as well as English language learners. So it'll be a completely different environment than daycare with older children. I'd like to say that it will be, because of logistics, I won't be as involved, but I think because of the funding issues, I would still have to.
I'm curious, would anyone here say your parents were helicopter parents, by the way, however you might define it?
Yeah.
Lena, actually, would you say your parents were helicopter parents?
But it's interesting, though, as you say, you know, we're sort of from a generation where you would have been really conscious of your parents being very involved in parts of your education. And now it must be incredibly hard not to be. The world has really turned in terms of maybe even how you perceive other parents and sort of the way they raise their kids based on something. So I would think most people here can sort of appreciate the pressure of feeling like the stakes are high with your kids' education, but also maybe knowing or not knowing what's going on. Actually, John, in that vein, I want to ask you a question that sort of bridges these two generations. For those of you who don't know the name Nancy Dickerson, John's mom, she was absolutely a pioneer in the news business. She's the person who blazed the trail for a lot of names you would recognize. And John himself is carried on in the tradition of journalism. But I'm thinking it must have taken a lot of pride and sacrifice for your mom in that era to be what she became. And I'm wondering if there are ways you're looking to try to be a better parent than your own parents, and if there are ways you're hoping your kids will improve on your own.
Well, we've, just starting with the last part first, we named our daughter, our second child, who's 7. She has her grandmother's name, so she's got that burden just on her from birth. We want to, make sure she doesn't screw up. It's, I think, constant. I would imagine this is the experience of a lot of people here, those of us whose parents were more detached, who, were there for recitals and graduations and things like that, but weren't around for the rest. We were all now totally and thoroughly involved in our kids' lives. And the detention for us and the challenge for us with our kids is letting them fail, hoping, in fact, at least in my case, hoping they fail, because lots of us have learned lots of important lessons from failing. And usually you fail because you're trying to do something that's slightly out of your comfort zone, and that is important in terms of stretching and becoming and living a richer life, is if you continue to take risks. But as a parent, of course, that's the most terrifying thing, is watching your kids fail, and especially if you know that if you just turn them in this like direction, they wouldn't fail. But of course, if you're constantly doing that, they have no innovation incentive risk taking on their own. So, to the extent that my parents weren't around a lot, there were a lot of instances in which, we were right at the edge of blowing ourselves up. I live now across the river from where I grew up in Virginia, and we used to shoot 22s across the river, which means I was basically shooting at the house I now live in. That kind of thing, we would have been several different issues of Dateline NBC. That was great because we did things that were risky and we learned, and so I worry that our kids who we are so involved with will miss some of that. And so I guess it's back to your original question, trying to be obviously much more involved than my own parents. Anne's parents are perfect. which is why she is.
We will be challenging that.
But it's, trying to find that right balance. And as far as what kids do, if they make it past being, our kids to adulthood, they've done fine.
I'm curious, as a parent, do you spend a lot of time thinking about the way you were raised?
Well, I have a slightly tricky. I wrote a book about my mother, and which was about my relationship with her. She had me when she was 42. She was on the air, and back then you didn't, as a woman on television, that was weird enough. But you definitely didn't want to be pregnant on television because, back to Amy's point, that made people think about how you became a pregnant woman on television. Now, of course, if you're a pregnant woman on television, the cameras are in the delivery room. Anyway, so she had me much later in life, and I wrote a book after she died about her life and my life and the intersections and occasional clashes. Protracted clash. I thought about it a lot more as a normal person.
And about that, because I suspect a lot of us have been there or will be, obviously there was a divide between you and your parents. How did you close the space, or did you close the space in your life over time?
I was lucky enough to close it. Well, I was just a jerk. I was like an adolescent boy, right? And adolescent girls have a version of this too. And so I was a mess. And my parents were, it was the normal clashes, but they were a little more protracted because both my parents were busy and consumed. And so I grew out of that, and also stumbling into the same business my mom was in. She had long passed it, but then we became quite close before she died. And I think also just the realizations we all have when we get older, and now especially with kids, where we realize, it's a lot more complicated. They were doing a lot more heroic work than we ever could have thought at the time, as we all fail and stumble at doing the simplest parts of parenting.
I'm curious, as an adult, do you think there was a time where maybe you never closed that space?
Well, because I guess we closed it before I would have gotten excessively contemplative about the relationship.
But, again, I suspect a lot of us, it's one of those questions where you think about the relationship you've had with your parents, and sometimes you feel the effect of time on that. It's like, what are the things you haven't said? What are maybe the air you've never cleared? There's obviously not one right way to do it, but intensely, heavily.
Well, yeah, I would say, I wish I had said a lot of things, which is a lot, that's for sure.
Reeves, I want to ask you something sort of on the other end of the spectrum. You've noted that sort of seeing the transition of generations, the aging of our parents' generation, has been a challenge in the past 5 years. I'm curious how that has affected your life.
Well, I think it's the caveat that I would say, first of all, is I find myself in sort of an interesting situation, and I think it's a blessing to have it. My father-in-law passed away in October. When I talked to my husband about it, he trained even any day. They have to deal with some of the complexities of aging parents, just at that time. So, it's an unusual circumstance. It's hard to watch your parents age. At the same time, I feel fortunate that I have the privilege to go through this age of life. It's a little awkward, being a newer parent, and recognizing just the clear distinction between parenting and engaging with your parents as they have emerging needs. And I would say, when you're with your kids and you're parenting, you can say, all right, here's what we're going to do. Sometimes you give them a choice, A or B, and get on a plan, and there you go. And with your parents, so it's very different. You say, Mom, I've also learned in my job, you don't should people. So you don't say, you should do this, Mom. You shouldn't should people, so I don't should her. I say, Mom, how does this strike you? Or maybe it would be useful to think about whatever. And she's very cordial, and she'll say, thank you. and then I'll try again, later on, and eventually, my brothers will call me and say, you gotta call Mom, and then my cousin will call me, you gotta call your mother, and I said, guys, I've talked to her, she's gonna do what she's gonna do. So, parenting and managing your parents are two very, very different animals, and
it's going to be interesting in the next years to sort of see that growth. My mom is 75, my dad is 81.
Does anyone here help move a parent into like assisted living or a retirement community? For those of you who have, did any of you face resistance from your parents?
My mom is actually in a nursing home, so she had really significant health issues and she had a stroke and really can't manage, you know, and her husband could no longer really care for her. So she had actually been in at one for rehab at one point and stayed because of the state of my stepfather, and then it happened again. And so the second time when it looked like it was really going to be where she was going to be because of a lot of safety issues and significant health issues, I just kind of didn't, you know, I just let it kind of play out. I just learned that it's such a huge loss to realize that your life is going to be spent in this way, and you have to kind of come to a peace with it. So I think, and also I'd had a son, and I really didn't have the time for it anymore. You know, I didn't have the time to be all up in her business anymore, you know? So I think that was a blessing because I had to, you know, I had a child really late and felt that that was such a gift, and I needed to focus on that, and that I could do so much for my mom, but really her life and some of her decision-making and some of the things that weren't related to her decision-making, that just were things that happened, were really beyond what I could control. And so I think that allowed me to kind of let the process sit. And so she and my stepdad kind of got to a place where he moved on. They moved out of their house, and it became not a choice to go home. And so it kind of answered itself.
Can I say, for a couple of others where you had your hands up, is there something you would have done differently? Do you feel like if you could sort of dealt with the situation over again, is there a piece of advice you'd share about people who might be going through that in the next couple of
years? In my case, I very proactively moved my mother to a lovely facility, Westminster Canterbury. I would move there tomorrow.
Still use that as a, you know, okay. No one's gonna die. It's not a harder or less. I can be really stubborn about talking about that. I can't afford to fix things for myself. Lowe's would be the last 2 years. I always had this, played this game in my head. I had only ever experienced growth in my business, in both businesses. And I mean, growth was 20%. So when you're in retail and you're managing inventory, that's a pretty heady thing. And I always did this game of, what if no one came in tomorrow and bought anything? What would that feel like? But it was never going to happen because it never happened. Well, it actually happened. In 2009, my business fucked up in the first month 40%. And by the end of the year, we finished up down 35%. And that percentage after 15 years of business was a significant dollar amount. Starting a business when it's just myself and one other person, it's an hourly rate. That doesn't feel scary, having 15 people on payroll who all have health insurance and dental, gym memberships, paid vacation, and then all of a sudden, you're supposed to have a $46,000 day, you have a $24,000 day. That's an epic period of the small business owner. What was the strangest about 2009 is nothing that I did worked. The sales that the store has are well known. We have women lining up in the morning to get in and buy shoes on our first day of our sale. We're established. It's an established business. What was unusual was to get to a point that no matter what I tried, it didn't work. And then you lose your confidence. And as an entrepreneur, you lose your confidence, you're done. But at the same time, this is all happening in public. I'm walking out on the sales floor every day and having people walk in going, and bless their hearts, but like, you used to have a lot of fill in the blank. You really don't have much right now. And I'd say, if you've read the papers. I'm going through right now with a recession. Like, no, but I just really expected to have fill in the blank. Well, you know, we're down. You guys aren't shopping. If you're not shopping, I can't really buy inventory. Well, I'm just going to go buy it online. So it was like, you have a baby. You get kind of stupid when you have a baby. You have a recession, and online shopping just... the highs have been like, wow, I really did this. I can look back and say, yeah, not a lot of businesses make it 17 years, and this is how much we've grown. And I can count 5 employees who've gone on to start their own businesses. Young women who say, best college job I ever had, best job I ever had. All of these things. So many wonderful moments at 5. And then in 2009, really feeling lost. Like I said, when you lose your confidence as an entrepreneur, you're done. You don't know what to do, how to do it. And all of a sudden, the things that made you know your business really strong, you second guess everything you do. So I would say 2009 was the low.
Scott, how about on your end, in an entrepreneurial role too, what have you learned about yourself in recent events?
A lot of similarities, a lot of differences. In my case, it's hard to say this way, but 2009 is the best thing that ever happened as a professional. My partner and I started a company that essentially sells weather insurance. And we did it under the flag of an insurance company named White Mountains. And when the financial crisis hit, they basically came to us and said, look, we like your business, you're making money, but it's not a quarter what we do, and we just lost $1 billion in the global financial crisis, so we need you guys to do nothing and just sit here and do nothing. And after 6 months, they said, you know, we'll get more capital and then we'll go on. And after 6 months, we're still out of our hands doing nothing. At that point, you have a bunch of people who are doing nothing and you're afraid that you're going to lose your business. So we approached them and said, you know, we're not doing anything. We're sitting here, we're drawing us actually go out on our own and form our own business. So without the global financial crisis, that would have never happened. I'd still be working for White Mountains. I'd still be in an insurance company, a large insurance company, in a small unit. So it was a great opportunity. And what we said when we drove off on our own is global financial crisis is going to be the best thing or the worst thing that ever happened to us. And we really didn't know which one it was going to be, because we basically had about a year and a half worth of financing and the plan to do what we did previously, but we had a bad year and a half. That was pretty much it. But we had a good year and a half, and like you said, you know, after that year and a half, then we had to figure out what we were going to do, because all we had was a short-term solution. We didn't really have a long-term solution. And then the pressure of, we have six employees, they all have, you know, healthcare, medical, 401k, their own families, their own problems, and all of a sudden, we have no revenues coming in, and at the end of the day, you're sitting there going, okay, well, now I'm using my own savings to make sure that other people can support their families. And that pressure was pretty intense. Something I don't like to think of right now, but when you guys said, you know, how's it? I said, you know, what's the hardest thing you ever had to go through? And I said, almost losing my business twice. So at the end of the day, we did get financing, we came through it, and I'd like to say that we're still a company, but it's really, really difficult when revenues slow for one reason or another, and you have to start making decisions on not just your own family, but other people's families, and how are they going to support themselves, and do you lay somebody off in this environment, or do you basically suck it up and put your own family at risk to make sure that that person has a job and try and get through it all together?
Yeah, that's the biggest challenge. You know, it's interesting, and why, sort of in that vein, but sort of on a very different side of the work in the world, let's talk about that point. Why is a city manager of Falls Church? It's a high-profile role, right sort of in the eyes of the community. There's no hiding. And it's been a horrible economic climate, plus, as a government employee, you frequently can be the target of the frustration people feel. And I'm wondering, you know, how, maybe in the vein of what Scott says, what have been the tough things for you personally about navigating the past couple of years?
I became city manager in 2006, and that's about when all the wheels started coming off. So I tried not to take that personally. Year after year, as we would continue to downsize and continue to not hit our revenue forecast, the shocking thing to learn after you've been in public service for a decade, where every year your revenue grew like yours did, and how in the public sector that can cover up mistakes, that can cover up a pretty loose sense of financial management, and you can have budget hearings where no one shows up and everybody gets what they want, toward the situation where you have to downsize your organization and the government. People expect to have their job until they retire, and it's just not a culture that people are expected to be laid off in. And you have town hall meetings where the room is packed and people are pissed. And on, you know, from a rational basis, you think back to 2005, your average homeowner's tax bill probably went up 12%, and nobody showed up, but that was because of assessed values. And then you could cut people's tax bill and have to do a lot of really big things to the organization, cut school funding, cut services, and people still are very unhappy about the fact that the tax bill is either staying flat or we're not declining enough. And all of my experience was very bad experience for what we had to go through. And so we had to learn on the fly about how to manage things differently. And it sounds a little dramatic, but you think of the old Congress who went through the Depression and how their attitudes never changed. I do think that this whole generation of local government managers and entrepreneurs. I think we won't ever think about things the same. Even if things were to get back to some kind of normal that was as it was before, I don't know whether it ever will or not, but I think our minds will never be the same.
Who here would say, however you want to define it, that the recession sort of displaced you, either personally or professionally? Yeah. One of the big issues we face, and within, whether it's government service, entrepreneurship, whatever, it's one of the big challenges, is the way we feel about the balance of our lives, made tougher by everything over the past couple of years. Panelists, I'd just like to hear what grade you would give to your work-life balance or your overall sense of balance in life. Reeves, let's start with you, actually.
They actually provided these questions in email beforehand, so thank you. So my husband wasn't able to join me. But we talked about some of these questions earlier in the week. And I said I would give myself a B. He said, yeah, a B most days. Some days it goes to a C.
What grade would you give him?
Struggle to make sure that everybody's needs are met, whether it's my children or my clients, my husband, just making sure that it all gets juggled. So the thing I've learned, well, first of all, I think every year, it's just, you sort of figure it out, and then you just get a new variable dumped on the plate, and then you get a new whole set of operating goals, and then you get another variable, and you're like, okay, and so now I feel like, it's just, I'm spinning every plate. But I wouldn't drop any of them off. And so that's the sort of thing that's interesting. I'd maybe work less because I think at the end of the day, the kids are going to be the things. They're going to be there at the end of the day. Hopefully I still have a job. But, you never know. But I would say I give myself a B. And then when I don't, I go for a swim. And then I get out of the pool and I think, okay, here's what I have to do. And I prioritize.
Right.
need more people, and I asked for more help because of we have all these releases coming up in the next 12 months. And I guess my, given the recession issues, we were reluctant to hire any more people. But it came to a head when I actually fainted after a 14-hour day at work, and I guess the threat of workers' comp.
Particular professor in the architecture school named W.G. Clark, who
of course, in a building like this, what would you do? 6, 5 years from now, new camel.
Professionally, I would agree with Nina as far as the cons are going, but personally, I would say Humphrey's dorm, second floor right. One of the people that kind of was on that ball is standing right over there, and he's the godfather of my children, and was my best man. And this past September, four of us came down, so we had 8 adults and their 12 children taking a football game. And, you know, when I think UVA, there's two things I think about. I think about the top school. I think about the guys on Humphreys that basically grew up together, basically, here at UVA.
John, how about you?
Well, I've already pandered once to my wife, so I can't do that again.
She's left. You can say anything now.
She's done here. No, really, we're fine. personally, obviously, that was the most important connection. But in terms of the school, the American Studies program that I was in, which was, you know, made that big school very small, was very intensive and fan. Spent a lot of time with Mr. Colbert, who ran it. And, you know, having that kind of intense relationship with a professor that goes over a period of time was really, really helpful.
And American Studies, I think, was a sort of a new program when we did.
Yeah, it was sort of new, and not many people knew about it. I don't know. It was, is it still around?
That could have been part of the quiz.
It's still around. Oh, fantastic. They didn't throw it out.
In, of course, very good ways, it would have been the University Journal, which doesn't exist anymore, but you might remember it was one of the Smith papers here. You know, Reeves has had a long tenure with her employer at Accenture. You know, I've been with my employer since a day and a half after graduation, which has many good things, but maybe for our next panel discussion, you know, we can also talk about bad things. One thing we really didn't get to touch on, but you, I'm sure, think about a lot, is how you feel about your capacity to change in life. You know, where sometimes your roots feel so deep, can you envision planting them somewhere else? Or can you see yourself doing or being something different than what you are? And, you know, I think that's a weight. I'll tell you, candidly, it's a weight I feel. Part of that is, I think, just sort of where we are in life. But, you know, sometimes you look at it, it's like, we got a lot of life left now. Life is hard. Much like this. All right, hands on buzzers, people. We're going to see just how smart you are. Just call out answers if you can remember some of these things from our undergraduate days. We're going to start down in the corner area. Deep breaths. Here we go. If you wanted a Gus Burger, where did you go? If you wanted Chicago-style pizza, where did you go? Who said who knows? Get out. You might recall Mincer's Pipe Shop. It was at University Avenue and what side street?
Ellingwood
Avenue. Locals. What well-known clothing store was down that street? Is it there now?
It is.
It's moved.
It's not.
See me after the panel. Name a bar on Ellingwood.
No more.
McAdoo's it. I'm not going to take that. There was Cooley Mills, the Biltmore, and Cooley Mills.
I think it was
all right, fine.
You're at the University of Maryland.
For your classes, you might remember you bought a bunch of photocopy discussion packets at Kinko's. What was the rival store from which you might have bought your stamps?
Autographics.
Very good. Long after we graduated, Bodo's finally made it to the corner.
Lucky 7.
Right next to the Lucky 7, which of course was Kinko's. Very good. What was there our first year?
Burger King.
What was the name? Let's go to the rugby area a little bit. What was the name of the open field and frequent mud pit below Sunderland? Very good. You might remember Beta Bridge. It showed off the artistic talents of many people, in a way. If you wanted to see something classier, what was the name of the UVA Art Museum in the area? Very good. Along artistic lines, that area is also home to the UVA Drama Department. So names like Culbert, Nelms, Heritage might be familiar. one Aaron Sorkin play, which became a well-known movie, debuted at UVA in 1989. Named male lead.
Tom Hulce,
best known for
Amadeus.
He played Mozart in Amadeus. That was world premiere here, and that was written by Aaron Sorkin. Who knew? Okay, let's go to Central Grounds really fast. When you filled out an ad drop form early in the semester, you dropped it off where?
Garrett Hall.
Nearby was Old Cabell. What was the name of the cafe in the basement?
Cabell Cave.
Cave. Many names, they were four letters. We'll take Cave. We're in Rouse Hall today. Old Cabell is diagonal from us. What's the building right next to it?
Wilson.
I was going to say Rogers. Did someone say Rogers?
No. Okay, fine.
Wilson Hall, home of the then. You remember Clemens Library? You couldn't have food or drink there. What was the nickname of the woman who would seize your beverage?
The Coke Lady.
We would also have accepted Coke Monster. That's Mike Hadley, basement left Hancock, very smart man, 16 years in the service. What was the name of the food court, first floor of Newcomb? What was the name of the club in the back?
Pavlovna.
It was? Okay, I couldn't remember. reminder, I might have brought this up 5 years ago. At that club, during our undergraduate years, there was a band called Alica's Attic that played there. Who was the lead singer? River Phoenix. Did you know? Not far away from Central Grounds is the UVA president's home. It's called Carson. Very good. And who was UVA president during our first 3 years? Bob O'Neill. Who's going to say? John Wilson Bloss. Bob O'Neill. Very good.
Sorry, I can't forget that.
Down the hill, of course, we have Mem Gym. What was the name of the field behind it? There were four upperclassmen dorms along Spring Lane near Alumni Hall. What were their names?
Lewis.
Lockme.
Munford.
Hoxton. Very good. Thank you. Let's go to the dorm and stadium area really fast. The new and old dorms were generally named for the streets that ran in front of them. They were
McCormick.
Below the old dorms was a recreation area called
Dell.
There was a rec center up the hill from the new dorms called
Clark. I'm not sure I've been here.
you remember O Hill Dining Hall, of course.
Yeah.
In the new dorm area around Tuttle was a cafe called
Treehouse.
And in the basement was a store called the
Root Cellar.
The Root Cellar. Thinking of O Hill, who was the strolling violinist our first year at Festa Genovese?
Boy Tinsley, the Dave Matthews Band.
There were two upperclassmen residence halls known as the Stadium Road dorms. They are
Gooch and Diller.
Did anyone here live in Gooch and Diller? Rounding off to the nearest 1,000, how many steps did you have to climb up to get to your room? Machu Picchu was less fun. Right near Scott Stadium in the parking lot was a structure known as the SAB. That stood for... That place also held concerts from time to time. In the late 80s, one hit wonder, Johnny Kemp, played there. What was his hit single?
Just Got Paid.
Just Got Paid. Reeves, the university guide, sponsored a ball every year to raise funds for what purpose?
Okay, let's try this then. Where are the colonnades located?
Will we accept that, judges? Very nice. In 1989, the first President Bush held a conference here on what topic? And who were the attendees?
Governors.
Name the performance troupe that University Union brought here our fourth year.
Oh,
the
Red Circus.
Close. Bread and Puppet. Very good. Very rainy day when they arrived. And now a final two questions, and Lena, prepare yourself, because you're getting the last one before we have a little bit of business to take care of. You might recall the Cavalier Daily and the University Journal. There was also a publication called The Declaration, or simply The Deck. What was the name of the irreverent column that was featured in every edition? Buddhist Corner. Very good. And now, thinking of The Deck, the last trivia question is going to go to Lena. The Deck, you might recall, even though we live in the era of Facebook right now, 20 years ago, it was the era of the Faces book, where you sent your high school graduation photo, and let me tell you, the hair was bigger than the smiles. I got it here. But you sent down to the Deck your picture, which was going to become a visual guide to our class, and you included your hometown, your intended course of study, and two activities or hobbies or interests that you held near and dear to your heart. Lena Ma. Rockville, Maryland. Business. Appropriate. What two activities, interests, or hobbies did you list?
I think it's probably movies and parties.
Not quite so sophisticated. Okay, it was yearbook and... Someone had apparently sent dancing and animals, but the comma was left out by the Deck. Guys, I'm going to reintroduce Jen Smalik now. She has a really quick announcement and some thanks. First, a quick note about Jen. She has been our class president, actually, not only when we were undergrads, but most importantly, her duties sort of extended beyond that. And the success of us as a reunion class, as shown with our attendance this weekend, has a lot to do with her efforts. She was an architect of the Young Alumni Council, which has actually changed the relationship between new graduating classes and alumni all in really profound ways. She's done a great job. Other classes are reaping the benefits of her efforts. Let's give her a hand.
Thank you again, everyone, for coming in. Enjoy your time.